This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, that's Motley Crue. Shout at the devil, and there are people in the control room making all kinds of body movements and head movements. There are people who really love this music. And what we're going to talk about in this segment is the effect that that music had, and particularly being what was known as a headbanger or a Metallica or heavy metal freak or whatever you want to call it, had on young people who grew up loving it. And actually, well, listening to those headbanging lyrics, I Want to Watch You Bleed or We Are Ready to Kill All Comers. You may recall, in fact, there was testimony by Dee Snider of Twisted Sister up on Capitol Hill and Tipper Gore back in 1985, and they put labels on a lot of these albums, as they were called at the time, because the feeling was that they were getting into young people's heads and really messing them up. There was, in fact, some concern not only about the lyrics, but even the music itself. There's a psychologist who said this was in kind of the sonic effect like war, listening to this music, and it certainly probably did some damage on eardrums. But whether it did damage emotionally is the question that Tasha Howe found herself working with and led a study. And the study is published in Self and Identity, and it revealed that the so-called metalheads were actually happier in their youth compared to their peers and are now better adjusted than current college students. So, Tasha Howe, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Wow, colonoscopies. That's a hard act to follow.
Well, we go from the police chief to colonoscopies to you. And what could make more sense in this universe of eclectic programming? I should say who and what you are. Tasha Howe is professor of psychology at Humboldt State University and led this study. And so it turns out that these young people who people thought were going to be all messed up in the head are significantly happier, were happier in their youth, and now better adjusted, kind of middle class, what I suppose would come under the rubric of normal adults?
Yeah, it was really interesting for us to do this study because the metalheads of the 80s had such a bad rap. You know, the general population thought they were going to be devil worshippers who died and didn't accomplish anything and were going to be miserable and depressed and on drugs. And what we found in comparing them to a middle-aged group who grew up in the 80s who did not like heavy metal, they liked pop or new wave instead, we found some interesting differences. To support the stereotypes, we found that the metalheads did have more risky sex, did take more drugs, did drink more alcohol. They definitely had the sex, drugs, and rock and roll lifestyle that we thought they had, but they also recollected their youth as being significantly more happy, more fun, more positive than the people who didn't like metal. They also did not seek counseling for emotional problems as much as the comparison group. They reported that they had very few regrets about anything they did in their youth compared to the other group. And on a lot of the variables, they were very similar to the comparison group in income, education, missing work for physical or emotional problems, personality traits, emotional attachment styles. So they were really very similar to other middle-aged people and quite well adjusted, but they looked back on their 80s youth as much more fun with fewer regrets, and I was really surprised by that.
But we should add here, because I think it's probably necessary to add, that these are the ones who made it through. I mean, there were probably some who either committed suicide or overdosed on drugs. You can't really find out those numbers, can you?
Right. That's the problem with using this type of snowball sampling technique is we use word of mouth in metal groups. And so the people who are dead or in jail or whatever are not going to be responding. But that's why it was so important to use a comparison group, because the same variables would affect the comparison group. Those who died or had horrible outcomes would not be participating in the study on their side either. So having two equivalent groups that were very similar to each other, except for the identity culture or style culture they identified with as youth, really helps us to get a clear picture because the attrition rates of the people who didn't participate or dropped out would be the same for each group. And we also used a comparison group of current college students because we wanted to control for maybe the things we found were just true of all teenagers or all youth. And so we wanted a current cohort of youth just to compare them to. So we tried to control for as many variables as we could that might muddy up the results.
And we should mention, just for full exposure, you were one of their numbers, I believe, were you not?
I was one of the heavy metal kids in the 80s, definitely. I was out there in Hollywood. I was a heavy metal groupie. I was living in the scene for sure. I was not participating in the study, but I was using my networks to snowball. The surveys were anonymous, so I have no idea who actually responded or not. And there were people from all over the country and all over the world that responded. We did ask them, what scene were you a part of? So most of them were in the Hollywood scene, Brooklyn, Australia, and there were several other locations of metal scenes that people were a part of.
We're talking to Natasha Howe, PhD and professor of psychology at Humboldt State, who conducted a study about what are broadly called metalheads and how they turned out. A lot of this cohort that you talked to, though, I suppose turned out okay or were gainfully employed and relatively well-educated middle-class people. The argument underneath this is because they had a community and a social support and a kind of kinship and belonging. Is that not true?
Yeah, we actually did another study that's not getting quite as much press as the self and identity article. We published a study earlier, I think about a year ago, in a journal called Sexuality and Culture. And in that article, we interviewed all the people. And so it's more qualitative and you can really see some nice quotes from people. And so that really gives insight when you do quantitative analyses with statistics. If anyone actually reads the self and identity article, it's full of statistics.
Where's the second article? Is it accessible?
You can Google it. I don't know if you would have to pay for it or not, but I can always email it to you if you want to look at it. So the Sexuality and Culture article is more qualitative. It's more in a sociology vein. And so that had in more in-depth interview questions with all the people. And we did the same with the comparison groups and the students as well. We just didn't publish that because Sexuality and Culture was more interested in gender and sexuality issues. So we focused a lot on gender groupies, musicians. Me being a groupie, it was really interesting for me to find this whole group of self-identified groupies who slept with rock stars, you know.
And what group were you a groupie for?
I was a groupie for any group that I liked at the time. I was a little Hollywood girl, and our whole goal in life was to meet rock stars and get backstage and go on tour and all that and take a lot of drugs and have a lot of sex in the meantime.
And you're here to tell that story. Well, actually,
I'm one of the well-adjusted.
I'm not going to ask your age, but this is mainly an age group of 35 to 60, I believe, now. We're talking about a fairly good span there, a demographic that's a fairly good span.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to invite those of you who managed to live through this period as being metalheads, or that is loving the heavy metal kind of work that we're talking about here, and music. You didn't have to be a groupie, but you may have been an enthusiast. You may have been part of that scene, and you may want to comment on what these results seem to show from your own perspective, or you may simply have a question or comment for the psychologist who led the study, Tasha Howe, who is with us this segment of Forum. And to join the program, you simply have to call us. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. So please feel free to join the program. And I can tell you, you know, looking back in retrospect, there was a tremendous amount of controversy about these lyrics, some of them satanic, some of them over the top with sexuality and with devil worship, but also with drug use and all of that sort of thing and violence. And many people thought this is going to lead to anarchy and all sorts of dreadful consequences. And here's a study that shows that kids turned out, for the most part, to be okay, at least those under study. You may want to ask the leader of the study some questions. And again, the opportunity to do so is by phone, 866-733-6786, or email us. Our email address is simply forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But please feel free to join the program. Here's, in fact, Greg, who writes on our Facebook page, I was a punk rocker in the 80s. I'm now a normal college professor, though by definition of normal is questionable. I'm happy. Another listener, Lila, writes, I'm a metalhead of the 90s and 2000s, specifically industrial metal. More popular bands people may know are Nine Inch Nails and Skinny Puppy. Most of these bands' material is extremely dark in the words and sound, and the concerts were certainly wrought with intense imagery. But think back to Greek theater. Everyone, including prisoners, were encouraged to go to the theater for catharsis and were exposed to stories of incest, mutilation, and the brutal wrath of the gods. They believed that exposure to this material would exorcise those parts of our personality so that we didn't have to live with them. I think she means exorcise. It's spelled like exercise. But anyway, she concludes, this is Lila again, certainly a theory, but perhaps a good one. 99.9% of the fellow lovers of metal I've ever known have been overachieving, intelligent, creative, and extremely empathetic, the men especially. Makes sense to you, Tina? Natasha, excuse me?
Oh, yeah.
I called you Tina because Tina Howe is a famous playwright who I admire. But oh. It's Tasha Howe. Yeah.
That's okay. Reflecting back on our article for Sexuality and Culture, and as well as my own childhood, what we found with the metalheads is they experienced higher levels of childhood trauma, of adverse childhood experiences, and during the interviews, they really talked about how metal served as a community. These style cultures of youth show you kind of a ready-made style, fashion, attitude. A lot of the lyrics were about political unrest, were about dissatisfaction with the status quo, hypocrisy in the government. And a lot of the metalheads talked about how the general public didn't realize the depth of the community of the metalheads, how complicated the music was to play. The people are really virtuosos in a lot of these metal bands. The singers were incredible. In fact, my husband was a heavy metal singer and he took opera lessons, and opera and metal have very similar vocal qualities. And so people really did gravitate towards this style culture to forge their sense of identity, to gain social support, to be with like-minded people. And in the interviews, people talked about how they were aware that they were in a very important time in history, and they could feel this social movement, and they felt like they were part of history. And when I look back at the bands that we were seeing in clubs back then, Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses and Poison, and some of these bands were just tiny club bands, we all could feel this momentum, like this was going somewhere. And by the end of the 80s, these were the biggest selling artists of any genre. And so it really did feel like we were part of a little revolution.
Well, just to go back to a point you made, though, they came generally, these metal fans like you, from families that were more troubled. Are you still a groupie for your husband, by the way? I just have to ask.
Of course. It's so funny that this article came out at this specific time, because he happened to just have been convinced to do a reunion album with his band, Metal Church. And so he's getting back in the studio, and then this article is getting all this media attention. And so it's been kind of a funny coincidence for us to reflect back on all the people we used to know back then, and just really think about where are they all now and what's happened to them. So that was part of the reasoning behind doing this study. And I had written a memoir about my life. And so reflecting on the chapters about the metal and groupie days was really interesting. There were so many characters that I would just love to know where they are now.
And again, Tasha Howe with us, professor of psychology at Humboldt State. And KQED Arts has put together a list of 5 Bay Area metal bands that changed the 80s. And you can find that link to that article on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. Let me go to your phone calls and let's begin. Joel, with you. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going.
It's going good. This is really cool. I was just driving to get some breakfast, and I saw this article on Facebook or something, and I just was lucky enough to be right here when it was on. This is great.
And what do you have to say to us, Joel?
Well, I just wanted to say that I listened to Suicidal Tendencies and Metallica and stuff when I was like 14, and I started getting really excited about that music, and then it became a super big part of my life. All the metal bands, all the hardcore punk bands, you know, from the Exploited to Slayer, all of them. I was into everything. And the thing that it did for me was I started getting in bands myself. I was more into punk and stuff, but I was always listening to metal, you know, and it gave a depth, I think, to my youth to be able to be a part of creating something, not just listening to something, that really made me happy. And I was in a band, just went on tour and stuff all through my 20s, and we had some amazing experiences. So I would most certainly agree with her that it gave a little something extra in my life that, I mean, I'm still doing it today.
Gave you a sense of identity, like the study seems to show. That's what you're saying, yes?
not just an identity, but also a creative outlet. When you're involved in this stuff and you do it yourself and you make it, it really adds something even more, you know, and it gives you a joy to your life.
Well, good to hear from you, Joel, and I appreciate hearing from you. Thank you for the call. You didn't do any studies on the effect on hearing, did you?
No, but just from the old metalheads I know, there is a bit of hearing loss involved.
Well, that can happen.
I think one study came out a few years ago that we laughed at that said if you go to a metal show, you should wear a neck brace for part of the time and only headbang on maybe every other song. It can cause some serious neck injuries.
Yeah, I would think so. We're going to get another caller. Jay, join us. Hi.
Hello, good morning. I was also a metalhead during that same period, and actually things weren't so rosy for me, unfortunately. I actually kind of regret the way I spent my time during those years, even though I have respect for the music. And the decisions I made during that period actually affected me well into my 30s. And what I'm referring to is the drugs and the alcohol that came along with the culture. And, you know, for a 15-year-old boy, that can be detrimental to brain development. I was really good in school. When I tried, my mother even started me early. I would have graduated from high school when I was 17, but I chose to drop out of high school because I wanted to party with all the metalheads, and I really paid for it. Didn't get myself my life in order until I was middle-aged.
Well, there's another side of the coin, and Jay, appreciate hearing from you. Response from you, Dr. Howe?
Yeah, I really feel for him. I'm sure he's not alone in that. We knew people who died at the time, too, because AIDS, you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll was right before AIDS. And so we knew a couple people who died of AIDS and drugs and car accidents and things like that. It would be really hard to figure out if that was because of metal, but you'd have to do an experimental study, which is impossible. But yeah, kids in all genres fall prey to drugs, and especially if they've had any kind of traumatic childhood, child abuse or alcoholism or mental illness in the family, which is actually what I do in my real life. In my day job is I study child abuse prevention and developmental psychopathology. So some kids who have no social support and really feel isolated, they can definitely come down on the bad side.
And let me thank the caller, and I'm going to go to some emails here. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us at 866-733-6786. Here's a listener who writes, I'd really be interested in reading the study. Can you please announce Ms. Howe's full citation? My almost 10-year-old grandson has become a Black Sabbath fan. That the entire family is fully in support of his interests. It's led him to reading more lyrics, writing songs, and studying guitar. So you can get the link on our website, as I said earlier, to the research, and please feel free to avail yourself of that. The website is kqed.org/forum. Heather writes, you suspect this pursuit was cathartic to adolescent angst. Also, in some ways, font-loading unbridled fun early in life can provide a buffer when life progresses and isn't so fun. Perhaps it helps the hard wiring. In fact, we're getting some interesting observations along those lines. Here's Bryce, who says, as we said on the farm, the wildest colts make the best horses. And Simon writes, classical music and metal light up similar areas of the brain. Give me Vivaldi and Slipknot or Hayden and Perfury any day. Another listener tweets, 666 middle fingers at my elementary school administration. Okay. We know that. And then here's Andy from up in Seattle, Washington, who says, a lot of my friends were metalheads in high school. I think one of the things that I remember about most of them and why they may be doing so well later in life is that they simply didn't take themselves that seriously and never took the content of their music seriously either. They were all kind of in on the joke. And they're still fun to hang out with after all these years. I graduated in 1984. There may be some truth to that, Tasha Howe. I mean, you know, all that, think about Ozzy Osbourne and biting chickens' heads off and everything. There was a kind
right.
of undercurrent of, we're all in on this together, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I don't recall meeting any metalheads that actually worshipped Satan or thought that the images that Iron Maiden portrayed on stage was a real monster or anything like that. But we did really take seriously the sense of it's us against them. It's us against the establishment, against the world. We really felt a lot of angst about society and the hypocrisy. And this was during Reagan times, which for a lot of us was a horrible time. It was a very narcissistic time, too. So both of those social trends kind of played into the metal at the time.
And we go to more of your calls. Nicole, you're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Okay, so I was actually calling Dr. Howe because I am a metalhead myself, and I just happened upon the radio show today as a subject, and I was wondering, random question, if you're actually accepting into your lab.
You would have to get into our graduate program at HSU. Most of the co-authors on my paper are all my students who had a blast doing this study. I really wanted to give them a genuine research experience that was super fun. So they were in some undergrads and also in our academic research master's program. So we're done with these sets of studies. But, you know, if you're interested in child abuse prevention, feel free to apply.
And we thank Nicole for the call. Actually, an interesting question from one of our listeners, Brian. Wasn't metal mostly a white middle class thing?
Yeah, it was. And I talk about that, especially in the sexuality and culture article. I talk about that it was really began in the 70s with white youth who felt disempowered because they didn't have all the white privilege that they saw in the media, the movies, the politicians. And so it was really a way for working class and poor white youth to sort of get their angst out and express their feelings of dissatisfaction with the way society was going and not reaping the privileges of the white middle class. And so, yeah, most of metal was white and sort of working class, hard scrabble people. But there were people of color involved in there. And I think, you know, people have contacted me who are people of color as well. But it was definitely more of a white middle class or white working class group.
Let me read a few more emails here. Cheryl writes, I'm not surprised by the findings that heavy metal music fans could turn out well-adjusted. While on the faculty at Harvard Medical School, I led a large government-funded study of the effects of violent video games on adolescents. In surveys and focus groups, we found that teens did not see violence in games as similar to or promoting real-life violence, but rather as a way to cope with angry feelings and especially with online games to work together in teams toward goals. There's a lot of mixed data on that, but let me just let that stand. Here's David, though, who says, I'm a metalhead. It seems obvious that the lyrics are fantasy. Like other entertainment, fantasy can capture your imagination and doesn't lead to anything other than appreciating the stories. The metal I like is progressive metal, so very technical, mostly instrumental, and very musically sophisticated. It's not easily accessible to most listeners, but it's super interesting when you take the time to appreciate it. I'm talking about bands like Animals as Leaders, Scale the Summit, and the Helix Nebula. Quick question, though, Tasha, some of that heavy metal got into, well, political stuff. In fact, there was a lot of skinhead and angry, almost, well, not even almost, some, you know, neo-Nazi stuff, too, wasn't there?
Yeah, especially over in Scandinavian metal. Some of the Norwegian metal, they actually got into some murders and some crazy stuff and white supremacy. That was definitely not the scene in any of the metal I was listening to in the 80s.
And not in Australia either, where your study also focused?
No, my some of the metalheads were from Australia that participated in my study, but I didn't, in any of the questions or answers, there was nothing racist, nothing, even not even really any sexism. Most of the professional musicians talked about the groupies with great respect and that we all wanted sex and we all knew what we were in for. And so I really saw very little in the way of sexism or racism, although the metal culture in general is quite sexist, which is maybe a topic for a different show that I could get into at another time.
So I have to certainly agree with you from what I remember about metal and that whole subculture. But here's Wayne. And by the way, sometimes you have to have kind of subgenres within the metal culture. You know, there are some that kind of border on real rock music in many ways and some that are just sort of hard metal and so forth. But here's Wayne who says, like many studies, this study appears to show positive correlation between heavy metal and well-adjustedness. Is there any casual evidence? Example, if I listened to more metal in my youth, I'd be more well-adjusted and successful today?
No, we were really addressing the early research and the political criticisms of metal, you know, Tipper Gore and all of the fear that people had. And so we were really trying to see, are metal people really that different from anyone else? And so we were pretty much hypothesizing that they wouldn't be that different. So we didn't expect them to be better adjusted in any way. We thought they might be similarly adjusted, which they were on a lot of the variables, very similar to the comparison groups. But we were surprised that on so many of the things, they were so happy, so few regrets, really not emotionally damaged. You know, we were surprised on the variables that they did come out ahead on.
We're talking again with Tasha Howe, who's professor of psychology at Humboldt State and the author of an article done in Self and Identity. And here's Tria, who writes, I was a teenager in the 80s and was not one of the kids listening to heavy metal, but one listening to New Wave, The Smiths, The Cure, The Alarm, U2, Thompson Twins, etc. Isn't it possible that those kids who were listening to more evolved, thoughtful music, i.e. more attuned to longing and sadness, would grow up more prone to depression and struggle? And perhaps the metalheads, those less sensitive, perhaps to such introspection, would go on to be happier. In other words, the music we listened did not shape us. It was simply a reflection of who we already were.
Well, definitely people with certain personality styles gravitate toward particular music, but I would beg to differ that metal was not introspective, sad, reflective. There was a lot of deep emotion in a lot of the metal I was listening to that really helped me through quite a difficult childhood. The people in our comparison group could choose new wave or pop music, or I think there were two other categories that were far removed from metal. And we had examples of specific groups before people endorsed their favorite music. So I definitely think she has a point that people with certain personality styles gravitate towards certain types of music. But when we looked, we measured personality. We measured, I think, 8 or 9 personality constructs, and the groups did not differ on any of those, except for the students maybe were more hypomanic and impulsive than the two middle-aged comparison groups.
We've got some criticism maybe of the study from you, Christina. Jurgens, welcome. Christina?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Christina.
I'm sorry we have to ask you to be brief, but go ahead, please.
Okay, I'm at Stanford in clinical research, and the only concern I have is with the fundamental study design. She talked about the attrition being comparable in the two groups, and I would question that. I think that the people who survived may be happy, but you don't have any count of the ones who really succumbed to the adverse events associated with drug overdose and alcohol intoxication.
I mentioned that at the top of the program, Christina, but let's get to the core of that concern. And Tasha, let me get you on record on that, please.
Right, yeah. We got the middle-age comparison group of people who identified with new wave and pop and other genres to be sure that what we were finding wasn't just a matter of growing up in the 80s or some other variables. So we, when we put the surveys out there, we didn't say that they were about metal. We just said we're looking for people between the ages of 35 and 60 to fill out surveys about their life in the 80s, their youthful experiences. So the comparison group came about when people endorsed a specific type of music over another type of music.
All right, I've got an email here from a listener who wants you to see if you can replicate the study with Deadheads. Thank you, Tasha Howe. Good to have you with us on Forum. And you hear the music going out of Metallica, No Remorse. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.